copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with me. Okay, so I worked at American Airlines. Anybody heard of them? Okay. And a gentleman comes in to check in, and he tells me he wants to go to Liberia. I said, great, let me check you in, sir. So I went into the computer, I pulled up the database information, I asked for his passport. I said, oh, looks like the country of Liberia requires a visa. As he has got a U.S. Passport. And then he said, I don't need a visa. I said, sir, you do. He said, I don't. I said, you do. He said, I don't. He said, I go there every month. I don't need a visa. I said, sir, the International Database of Passports says if you hold an American passport, you cannot enter the country of Liberia without a visa. He said, I'm not going to the country of Liberia. I'm going to Liberia and Costa Rica. Well, yeah, that would help if you clarify that. So I went ahead and processed him. No, he didn't need a visa to do that since he was an American citizen. But here's the problem. We were using the same terminology with a different reference point, with a different dictionary. And this is one of the classic problems in contemporary culture in dealing with religious issues and spiritual issues and with cults as well. They use the same terminology you're using with a vastly different reference point. So the vast majority of people, and I'm getting guys around 90 to 95%, that tell me I do not believe in your God or your Christianity, which happens to me a lot at the college where I teach, very secular college, I'll ask a simple question. Tell me about the God you don't believe in. Tell me about the Christianity you reject. And I'm not kidding you. The vast majority of them give me an answer that I would also reject. I reject that God too. I reject that Christianity too. This is called a caricature. That's the problem of trying to bridge the gap between what's in the mind of the unbeliever or the mind of those who reject and what you think. That's why it is so important to ask questions. My brother Henrik mentioned the book Tactics by Gregory Kokel. One of the most important things he mentioned in the book Tactics was to ask the simple question, what do you mean by that? So when I'm at a bus stop and I'm waiting and somebody tells me I believe in God, well, me too, high five. Hold on a minute. What God do you believe in? Now I might get myself in trouble by asking that question, but it's important to clarify what do you mean by what you say, especially regarding such volatile issues and such life-changing issues as the spiritual. So in dealing with this talk today, I'll be giving you three strategies that made a difference in my life, where I was teaching for the last 15 years, that have been effective in some measure. Of course, there's always exceptions. But overall, these have been helping me, and I hope by the grace of God, they'll help you. And we'll learn from each other as we move on. Now, we live in a world of weapons of mass distraction. Facebook and Google and Twitter and Instagram and these others, I don't even know what they are. They distract us, that fill our lives up, whether they're sports, TV, the sports scene or the bar scene for some young people. Even education can be a form of distraction. We need to be able to cut through that and use it to our advantage. And many great Christian writers and thinkers are using the social media medium to do that. Are you? Are you engaging in the world in that realm? Use the distractions to your advantage. I try to, and with some degree of success. Aldous Huxley told us that we have an infinite appetite for distractions. And Pascal said, one of the main problems man has is that he does not know how to sit quietly in his own room. If you haven't read Pascal, I strongly recommend him. And as I'm going through this, what I'll be talking about is a lot of the things that Christian scholars and thinkers of the past, people that we stand on their shoulders, have talked about. Great thinkers. One of the most prominent books in movers and shakers in the field is Niebuhr's book, Christ in Culture. If you haven't read this piece of literature, I strongly recommend you do. Almost every culture shaker and maker in the Christian world who's trying to make a difference in writing about it has referenced this book in one form or another. What he does there is break down four or five different ways that we can engage culture, or Christians have engaged culture. One of them is that we can go against culture. And some have done that. Christ and Christians against culture. Another form that we could deal with is we could be of the culture itself, kind of like blend in, be one of them. A third option he mentioned is that we can be above the culture, rise up above it. In Illinois, where I live, in the States, and I'm originally from Jordan, there's a place called Zion, Illinois, which is named after the biblical place. If you look into the research behind that, many Christians have tried to break away from the world to create their own little Zion. What ends up happening is we recognize something there. There's sin there too. And it boils up there. And it's actually worse sometimes when the people of God do it. Actually, it is worse. There's a Christ above. Well, then there's number four, the Christ in culture and paradox. So we're constantly in flux, constantly at war with each other, but we're with each other. And number five that Niebuhr talks about is that Christ can be the transformer of culture. And this is the one the vast majority of evangelicals has taken on board. There are always exceptions of pockets of us who want to break away and leave the world. Sometimes I feel that way. And sometimes I just want to be part of it. So there's a flux. But overall, the Christ, the transformer of culture, seems to be the big move of what we're going to do. Transform, baptize the culture. A book that picked up after that by D.A. Carson is Christ and Culture Revisited, which I recommend to you. And he takes his work and adds more to it and makes it more contemporary. For those of you who do not have English as your primary language, if I am going too quick, just simply raise a little bit of your hand and let me know, and I'll slow down a little bit. One of my favorites is Oz Guinness and his work. He's definitely a culture shaker, culture maker in his own right. It's Fool's Talk. This book revolutionized my apologetic. It really made me think deeper about how to do it and to do it better. So I strongly recommend that to you and his work. What's a talk about engaging the culture for Christ without talking about what Christ actually said about it? So you've been told, and I've been told, that we are to be in the world but not of the world. Have you heard that? Be in the world but not of the world. What on earth does that mean? I'm in the world, how am I not of it? How do I divide the two? I'm working with them, I'm eating with them, I'm laughing at their jokes. Sometimes. But I'm there. So one of the keys is to actually read the passage. As the Father has sent me, so I send you, Christ said in John 20. This is also referenced in John 17, the high priestly prayer, where Christ says, though as the Father has given me the ability to engage the world, so I give it to you, or I ask you. He sent me into the world, so I send you. So we're to be sent into the world. Yes, we're not the same as the world, but we're in it in one sense. In another sense, we are. We're humans. We all put on our pants the same way. We dress. We engage with each other. So we're called to go into the world to make the difference. See yourself as a change agent for God, an ambassador for Him. Whatever you do reflects upon Him. And sadly, there is no silver bullet. The silver bullet metaphor comes from the Lycanthrope mythology, which I'm big on. The silver bullet is supposed to be the one bullet who can kill the werewolf. There's a one bullet, it's a metaphor that goes on. And it's been used in others as well, other genres. But there's no one way to engage culture. And all the great movers and thinkers will tell you that. I mean, come on, take a look at the miracles of Jesus Christ. One day he's spitting on the floor in somebody's eye. Another thing he's saying, go home, your servant's healed. He does a myriad of different ways. There's no one way to do things with the living God. Although there's an umbrella of love and justice and peace and ethics we can follow. But there's not one way. But there are different methods that have worked for some of us so we can help with others. And that's what I'm presenting to you today. So strategy number one is sit at the table. What do I mean by that? Well, I'll be using the metaphor of the table throughout this talk. Sit at the table is get a seat at the table of the movers and shakers in your world, in your culture, in your city. Who is making the decisions? Who's presenting the options of what to put on television, of what to teach in the public school, of what parade to allow in town, of what to have at the next beach party. Who's making those decisions? Why are you sitting by and complaining about it? Get on the scene. Join the people who are making these decisions. Be part of the decision making. Do it as an ambassador so your light can shine and make a difference and transform that part of the world. How do you get a seat at the table? You get a seat at the table by presenting yourself as somebody who is full of integrity. If you're going to work with the engineers, you need to get an engineering degree. You need to get licensed. You need to understand how that works and to do it well. One of my friends works in heating and air conditioning. And when he goes into a house, he does his work, and sometimes he stays an extra 2 hours to make sure he does it in the absolute best way he's done, because he's representing Jesus Christ. And when he leaves, they know that his work is exemplary. And now when he speaks about spiritual things, they listen rather than, why is my heater leaking? You forgot that piece. So the work you do sends a message to those around you. I am qualified to do this, whether I'm going to work with the government or work with a university, whether I'm going to write a book or whether I'm going to ride a bike. Am I going to do it to the best of my ability, to the glory of God, so I can get a seat at the table? And when they try to reject me, it will not be because of my scholarship or the quality of my work or the things I said or the things I did. It will be because of the message itself. Get a seat at the table. That's strategy number one. And when you do this, keep in mind that you don't do it to convert people, although there are some disagreements among what actually that means. But are we after converting the world? Well, yeah, I want them to convert. But another sense, I don't. In one sense, I want to love them whether they convert or not. Why? Well, there's a theological reason, and here it is. It comes from guess who? The Lord himself, who said, no man can come to me unless the Father draws him. And one of the scholars told me that the word actually in Greek is drags him to me. And I, get this, this is really nice, awesome. I will raise him up at the last day. So all of us who hope in Christ, one day we will also be raised. So that when I'm reaching the world, I'm not trying to convert them because I can't do it anyway. No matter how much I preach and talk and sing, and people say apologetics doesn't convert people. Well, neither does your love. Nothing else does. Guess who converts? Him. He converts people. God converts people. He's the one who softens the heart. All you are is the instrument in his hand. So we propose, we don't impose a message. So I got a privilege to teach at Oxford University, and I still do it periodically. I'm on the extended staff. And one of my students in my philosophy of religion course was named Pauline. She started the course when she was 70 years old. Extreme skeptic. Well, very atheistic, but brilliant. I mean, she read more books than some of the Library of Congress, it seems. She knew everything about every major topic that we talked about and did circles around me. But we kept in touch after the class. And over again, she would send me these long exposés of objections, and I'd do my best to respond. And sometimes it satisfied, sometimes it didn't. You've been there. And there are times you shake the dust off your feet and walk away, but other times you stay in the fire. And then for her, I stayed, because she seemed genuinely interested and kept coming after me. So after a while, she told me, Professor Khaldun, are you trying to convert me? Are you trying to convert me? Of course, she was British. I said, no. I'm trying to love you. She stopped and said, Okay, let's continue this then. So we did. And at the age of 75, she calls me up 5 years later after constant conversations in Manchester, England, that she's getting baptized. Are you serious? I almost dropped the phone. She said, yes, I'm joining your community. I cannot ignore the man of the cross any longer. And here's a picture of Pauline. She's no longer my friend. She's my sister. Well, my friend too. Okay. So, with that said, sit at the table means A part of it is loving your enemy, loving the people around you. Now, what do I mean by enemy? So I threw that word out. Is the other side the enemy? Who is the enemy? Well, the answer may surprise you, or those of you who are philosophically astute, it won't. But it's not necessarily the guy on the other side of the table. It's not necessarily those who are propagating these ridiculous agendas in culture that are bringing us down and further closer to the gates of ethical hell. Their problem. It's not the demons and the demonic. It's something else. I'll talk about that as we move on. So here are some more examples of how this actually works, of getting at the table. Has anybody ever seen the great docudrama called The Bible? It's the most watched documentary in history. Did you know that? Here's the story of it. Mark Burnett and Roma Downey were actually the producers of a show called The Celebrity Apprentice, which made Donald Trump famous. So we won't go there for now. We asked to invest, they were asked to create a film that would debunk the Bible. So they spent their time making a film that did the exact opposite. Because of the quality of their work, the producers let it go. And it go, it did. It was number 2 on Amazon's bestseller list in the world with over 100 million views. They used it to transform their culture. And it's doing it little by little. And they sat at the table to do it. Another example is the king. This is from my country. I'm a dual citizen in Jordan. King Hussein, who died a few years ago, what he would do is something amazing that you don't hear happening here. The Secret Service will have a fit if this happens. What he'd do is try to escape from his own Secret Service and go into the city. He'd change his hair gear, he'd put another gear on, and he'd walk up and ask for coffee and ask, "Tell me about the politics. Tell me about the king. Tell me about how things work." He'd dress up like a poor man and walk into a hospital and ask for aid. He'd walk up to the people selling hummus on the side of the road and ask them how the tax system is for them. And of course, finally, the Secret Service would freak out when he'd disappear and go after him. The BBC called him the King of Disguises. His son, Abdullah, tries to do that a little bit to mimic his father today in Jordan. And there are stories of him as well. King Abdullah and his family have been good to the people. They are Muslims, but they've been good to the people. Unlike the neighboring countries of Iraq, Libya, Syria, Egypt, etc. So Jordan is pretty stable. But I would call what he's doing incarnational orthopraxy. Incarnational orthopraxy, where he's bringing in incarnation what he believes in his being to the people. Isn't that what Christ did? He walked among us. He bled among us. Are you being part of the world in that way? That's just an example from somebody who doesn't necessarily share our worldview. And another example. So I'm giving a talk here on the superheroes. Yes, I get to use my childhood fantasies in my scholarship. Is that great? Daredevil. So I watched the series Daredevil, and then I wrote about it on my blog. My website is logicallyfaithful.com. And get this, the very next day I get an invitation in Manhattan, New York with the producers of the show. And I went there, of course, flew out. And I was on the panel discussion talking about how we can redeem, get this, culture with the arts. And I was the token philosopher there. I was trying to make a difference by speaking the words of Christ, not compromising them, but doing it with wisdom and respect of those around who are actually trying to make a living in what they're doing and try to do it right. They're trying to do it right. Some of them not, but those others were. That's just another example for you of engaging and sitting at the table. If you're interested, that's a clip from the show when we were on the panel discussion. Of course, you could tell me I'm the one with the lacking follicles there. I'm giving the talk on the superheroes 2 more times at 10:15 tomorrow in room 3-5 and 4:15 in room 4-4. If you're interested in that genre. Okay, let's move on. Strategy number 2, inquire. Strategy number 1 was engage, which is sit at the table. Strategy number 2 is inquire, which is ask the important questions. And as you do that, you're getting into something called the blind spots. Now, a blind spot is the blind spot. How many of you are drivers? Okay? So there's a spot that you cannot see when you're driving. It's called the blind spot. So, and there's also a spot that you can't see. Those of you who are married know what I'm talking about because they all see them. The wife always sees it. Sees it very well. The blind spot is what you cannot see. So there are things in our culture that they cannot see. And it's our job, one of the things we can do as thinkers, movers and shakers, is to point these out. What do I mean by these? For example, some of my ethical and skeptical friends will tell me, we don't tolerate your contradictions in your Bible and in the church. So okay, let's break that down. Instead of engaging what those are, which there's an avenue and a time for that, what we could do is turn the table. And this is part of the metaphor I'm giving you. Turn the table. You say there are no absolutes, my friends. That's correct. Everything is relative. Okay, then why does a woman have an absolute right to an abortion? There are no absolutes. That's right. Then why should we treat LGBT, gay, and lesbian people with respect? Absolutely. We should not be invading other countries and taking their oil. You mean that's objectively wrong? After all, in our culture, we thought it's okay. Oh, there's something wrong with that. Objectively, right? Do you not see that you also live in some type of contradiction, my friend? Let's turn the table and show them their own contradictions. And that usually would help in that realm. We allow all points of view, do you? Including biblical views of sexuality to be taught in the college and university? I just did a panel discussion on homosexuality a few years ago. I do many panel discussions. That was the only one they shut down because I'm being intolerant. I wasn't being intolerant. But anyway, it's fascinating. It's the tolerant question is coming from those who are most tolerant, but I won't go there. You've heard that enough. But that was interesting to me, and I wrote so many angry letters, guys, to the staff and the people who were asking for my resignation, and I didn't send one. I ended up deleting them all. Because once I calmed down, this is not the way to be an ambassador. No, it's not. There are times to write and engage people, you know, turn the tables in the temple. There are times to do it. For me, in that time, it wasn't right. So recognize and point out to our friends, there are contradictions in what you're saying. One of my colleagues at the college wrote me a letter regarding what happened in Orlando, Florida last year. The worst mass killing in the history of the United States was in a nightclub, a gay nightclub. Over 50 men were executed, some at close range. And he wrote me an email saying, since you are a homophobe, that's a subject, by the way, what would you think about the execution of these poor men? Oh, I wrote the angry letter too. Delete. And I thought about it. I wrote back, well, let me ask you this, I asked him. Since you are a Christianophobe, what do you think about the killing of ISIS? The ISIS executing people, since you are part of that, since you are an enabler of that, right? No, of course not. Then is it fair to call me these sophomoric high schoolish names to blame me for the execution of those? That's not fair, is it, brother? So we had an interesting conversation after that. There are a lot of blind spots in culture. Point them out. But do it, of course, with wisdom. So what you do is you turn the table. And then, of course, the scriptures again tell us to be wise in the way toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your grace in conversation always be filled with grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. What does that mean to be seasoned with salt? It means different things in different cultures. In Jordan, it means going right into their face and talking to them because we're very confrontational, us Arabs. But you go to other places, or you know, some of the people in the Middle East will tell you that's the case, and some people, they want you to be upfront. But in other places, you can't. They're just not part of their culture. They want you to slowly dance around it and tell them, right? You've been there? I'm talking about. Okay, so the grace here is contextual to how your culture interacts with that. So the plan is to turn the table. Help them see what they do not want to see. One of the greatest examples in all of literature of how this is done is King David and Nathan, the prophet. So King David takes this woman who is not his, impregnates her. Does he do it willfully? Does she do it willfully? He could have raped her. We don't know. Sends her back home. She sends a letter saying, dear King David, I'm pregnant, side B. What does David do? Own up? No. Orders the execution of her husband, including the other men on the front of the firing line. If you read what Joab did, his commander, he had other men killed with him. And then he covers it up and then tries to marry her as if anybody else didn't know what happened. Then the text says these haunting words. What David did displeased the Lord. But God waited over 9 months, 8 months actually. We don't know exactly. It was about 9 months, about a year later. Nathan shows up at the palace and says to David, David, you're condemned. No. He does something brilliant. He tells David a story about something in David's past, because David was a shepherd. There was a poor man with one lamb who ate from his plate and slept in the bed with his kids. It was like a child to him. And then next to him lived a rich man who had multiple lambs, who had a guest for the evening. He went to the poor man, stole his lamb, and killed it. Tell me, O king, what should be done to that man? David rises from his throne and says, that man deserves to die. And Nathan looks at him and says the most infamous words in all the scriptures. You are that man. God gave you multiple wives. He gave you the whole kingdom, David. And if it wasn't enough, he would have given you more. You took Uriah's wife as your own and slayed him. Because of what you've done, the child born from her will die. David falls on his face and says, what I have done, I have sinned against God. But get this, Nathan did not condemn him. David condemned himself. What Nathan did is he turned the table. Turned the table. Let them do it. Why tell the person that he's committing all these crimes and homosexual problems or promiscuity or whatever it is he's doing? Is it really our place even to do that? In some cases it is. In others, let them do it themselves. Another example, many of you have gotten into these discussions on abortion, of course. I'm walking down the street close to Michigan Avenue in Chicago. If you haven't been, you got to visit. It's beautiful. A young lady comes up to me as I'm wandering around the streets waiting for my wife to finish her nails, trying to make myself worthy somewhere. A girl comes up to me with a pad and says, would you sign this pad? I said, what's this? This is a petition to help Planned Parenthood continue funding, continue doing what they can to help women's health. And if you don't know, Planned Parenthood is the number one provider of abortions in the world, not just the U.S. So I asked her, well, what about the issue of abortion? She said, well, what about it? I mean, that's only something we do on the side. That's not the major issue. Well, that's one of the reasons the Republicans were trying to shut that down. I said, yes. And let me ask you, I said, what do you think about abortion? She said, well, I don't personally agree with it, but I don't want to impose my views on others. And we've heard that over and over again. It's almost a mantra. So I asked, why are you against abortion? And she said, because it's a killing of an innocent child. I'm not going to be part of that. Let me ask you this. Why are you outside here with a petition telling other people to sign this so you can execute innocent human children? She said, I don't do that. I never said that. I said, actually, you did. I'm just using your own words. She said, I never thought about that. Could you never think about it? Anyway, she said, I just got to get this signed. I'm doing this for my classes. So, well, let's talk about the lives involved here, including your own. Isn't there something else you could do with your time since you don't actually believe this? You said it. I didn't. Turn the tables. Turn the tables. That was strategy number two, which is inquire. Edify. That's the final strategy. This is reach across the table. So the first strategy is sit at the table. The second strategy is turn the table. Don't flip the table on them. They used to write to flip them. Let me show you what you're wrong, you idiot. No, that doesn't work too well. So you turn the table. And then strategy number three is reach across the table. Reach across the table. How do you do it? Well, that's the part of love where I give you the example of my friend Pauline. So many people today have sprouted this mantra. Heard this before? I am spiritual, not religious. At least they're not saying I'm not religious or spiritual. That would be a little bit of a problem. So they're saying that they embrace some kind of transcendence. There's something beyond myself. It may be type of Oprah type of religion of New Age, whatever it is in that sense. But what do you do with these types of people and reaching across the table with them? They're more, they're open in one sense and closed in another. So you have to gauge how you're going to deal with them. So this type of person, which I found a lot among the students in my college, is you ask questions. What's the difference between the two? And the more spiritual you are, don't you start creating your own system and creating your own religion? After a while, it does. And you also find with this, is, and you ask the questions I ask, is the following. Tell me, what's keeping you morally and spiritually accountable? How do you recognize and know when you're going off the charts? Because the spiritual world could be a dangerous place. You may be going into very dark waters. There are also dark forces out there. Do you agree? So yeah. And one of the questions I ask is, what is your spiritual compass? So, what do you mean? Well, how do you know what you're following is actually true and right and good, rather than a manipulation of others that are feeding that to you through subculture and pop culture? Do you have a compass? Not really. Well, what's your compass, sir? Well, my compass. Well, let me tell you about my compass. And I point that out, and the conversation ensues. And I think that's helpful in engaging people in that realm. If anybody's seen the most recent research on the issue of those who are leaving the church, have you seen that propagated over and over in different ways? The question is why? What, is there any good data? I'm always wondering if people are exaggerating the data, because we exaggerate data. Many of us do. And you've heard the talk, there are statistics, good statistics, bad statistics, and what's the last one? Lies, lies, more lies, and then there are statistics. Nice. And then dang statistics or dang whatever it is. The problem is with statistics is how do we gauge them properly? Well, I've done some research with some of my colleagues on this. The General Social Survey, this is a great major resource. The University of Chicago's National Opinion Research Council, consisting of research of over 60,000 students. The National Religious Landscape Study, which was conducted by the Pew Research Organization, very reputable organizations. And finally, the National Study of Youth Religion, conducted by the University of Carolina, Chapel Hill. They have concluded the following. Fully one-third of Christians, those are committed ones, 36% agree. I don't feel that I can ask my most pressing life questions in the church. They concluded that unresolved doubt and unanswered questions about Christianity are the key factors in the movement and why so many people are away from Christ. And thus, our research strongly indicates the neglect of apologetics as a root cause of decline in Christianity. This is coming from the Pew Research, General Social Survey, University of Chicago National Survey Research, the Religious Landscape Study, and National Study of Youth and Religion. And here are some of the top reasons given that they have a hard time problem or processing. Number one was the Bible. The problems of the Bible, does it make sense, etc. Questions about it. Number two was the existence of God. And number three is creation. Mostly that dealt with the issue of evolution and creation and science and religion, which is a whole avenue that we could get into to provide a rational defense to those who are listening. By the way, let me pause here for a moment. One of our favorite verses as apologists is 1 Peter 3:15, right? Yes, thank you, Janet. Always set apart Christ as Lord in your heart, being ready to prepare and give a defense for the hope that is within you, but do this with gentleness and respect. But there's another part of that verse. We don't usually quote it. To those who ask. So I'm in Romania, in the mall, walking around, waiting for my wife again. I don't know what else she's doing. And this lady comes up to me and wants to sell me nail shiner, you know, the one that shines nails. And she recognizes by my accent that I'm American, Jordanian, whatever it is. And she says, no, you have to buy this. I don't need a nail shiner. No, she goes on and on about why I need a nail shiner. I'll tell you, it's about 15 minutes of trying to get away from the nail shiner as much as I can. So I finally escaped. But many of us sometimes try to give reasons for the hope around us to people who are just not asking. They're not asking. So why waste your time? They may not be ready spiritually at that time in their life to receive what you're telling them. Maybe somebody else will come along and do that. This is, of course, different than evangelism. Apologetics and evangelism, they overlap, but they're different. Evangelism has its place. But the text is to those who ask. I remember going around as a young apologist, giving reasons to everyone who has a question, but they weren't asking. So those who ask, the field is ready. Keep your eyes open for that ready field. So in conclusion, the best way to reach across the table is to love. It sounds like a cliche. We've heard it over and over again as an epitaph. Love, love, love. What do you mean by love? Love, 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 love. Okay. Now, what I mean by love is sacrificially living out your faith to others, even when it hurts. And sometimes, especially when it hurts. You want to retaliate, don't you? You want to. Where Jesus says, if anybody strikes you in the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Generally, that's been interpreted to as crime, as being hit actually in the face. It's not. If I'm hitting you in the face, I'm using my right hand, and it's not hitting you on your right, on your. Jesus says, if somebody strikes you on the left cheek, I'm not hitting you on the left cheek. I'm hitting you on the right cheek, aren't I? Ah, so he's not talking about a fist. He's talking about an insult. Do not return an insult in the same way. Love them even when it hurts. Maybe we can close with this example. This is from Mary Chaplin's book, Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy. The book told of the suffering of the true church in Yugoslavia. Anybody from that part of the world? Your brother. I thought you were Romanian.
Bosnian.
Excuse me. Bosnia. Okay, close by. There's so much wrong with how the church has been used there, which has gone on in the name of Christ for decades there. One day, an evangelist by the name of Jakov arrived in a certain village. He was commiserating with an elderly man named Samarian on the tragedies that he had experienced under the, quote, love of Christ. Samarian abruptly interrupted him and told him that he had nothing to do with Christianity. He reminded Jakov of the dreadful history of the church, how it was replete with plunder, exploitation, blackmail, and killing of innocent people. My own nephew was killed by them, he said, and abruptly tried to stop any efforts by Jakov of talking about Christ. Those who wear those crosses carry a heavy commission, but their evil designs I cannot ignore. Jakov, looking for an occasion to get Samarian to change his line of thinking, said, Samarian, can I ask you a question? Suppose I were to steal your coat and put it on and break into a bank. And the police came after me, but couldn't catch me. And the next day, they arrested you because it was your coat. What would you say? I would deny it, Samarian said. Ah, but we saw your coat, they said. Jakov recognized the analogy and told them in an annoyed way, get out of my house. Jakov continued to return to the village periodically just to befriend Samarian, encouraging him with the love of Christ. Finally, one day, Samarian asked him, how does one become a Christian? Jakov taught him the simple steps of repentance for sin and trust of Christ Jesus, and gently pointed him to the shepherd of his soul. Samarian bent his knee in the soil and his head bowed and surrendered his life to Christ. As he rose, wiping his tears, he embraced Jakov and said, thank you for being in my life. And he pointed to the heavens and said, you wear his cloak well. So remember when I asked you what's the enemy? The number one threat against Christianity today is not secularism or liberalism or cultural wearing Christians or Marxists or Darwinists or liberals or conservatives or hawks in the military or even the devil. They're all great threats, but they're not the greatest. No, the greatest threat to Christianity is me. My drive to selfishly replace God by my own desires. Each and every one of us can be an agent for him or for something else. Either in commission of sins, by doing what we ought not to do, or worse, omission, not doing what we ought to do. You, ladies and gentlemen, are the light of the world, but you're also the salt of the earth. Go be that light. Too much salt is merciless. Too much light is blinding. Do it in wisdom. and go be Jesus to people, one life at a time. Thank you.
Thank you.